Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Ross Camage, and to begin, he presented a case from his practice, a 53-year-old woman with metastatic adenocarcinoma and an EGFR tumor mutation.
She presented in 2009 with left hip pain, turned out to have a lytic lesion there. That was biopsied. The bone was biopsied in that left iliac region, TTF1 positive adenocarcinoma, and staging investigation showed T1, she had a 2.5 centimeter right lower lobe mass, N3 disease, bilateral mediastinal disease, but M1B disease. She had, in addition to the left iliac bone met, she had an L5 bone lesion and three brain metastases on the MRI. She was initially treated with gamma knife to the three lesions in the brain, and then palliative radiotherapy. These were painful bone lesions with 30 gray and 10 fractions to the left hip and the L5 lesion. She was started on carboplatin and pemetrexed and went through four cycles with a best response of stable disease. An analysis of that bone biopsy had revealed an L858R EGFR mutation, and so she went straight on to switch maintenance with allotinib and had a further deepening of a response. As I said, it was mostly stable disease beforehand, pretty much from March 2010 through March 2011, so a year before she started to progress, and this time she's progressing in the lung.
So this lady fits into a pretty common situation in that she was on a TKI for a year and then had disease progression. Was she symptomatic when she progressed?
She wasn't, no. It was really just showing up on the scans. It was mostly the lung lesion that was progressing. Bear in mind that her two bone lesions had been irradiated. And so she was being treated in the community at this point in time. And what her treating physician did was they stopped the allotinib and they switched her to chemotherapy. She went on to initially pemetrexed with a best response of stable disease before progressing after four cycles. And then she was starting to be referred for a range of different clinical trials. She lives in Chicago and she was treated initially with a PARP inhibitor and then a multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitor. Again, each time with, you know, little in the way of response, tended to progress a little bit each time. She developed some new brain metastases, got gamma knife therapy for that. And, you know, at this point in time, she's now progressing on all of these trial therapies. She gets re-biopsied. People are starting to become aware of the different mechanisms of resistance you can get. Still sees the L858R EGFR mutation. No apparent evidence of that second EGFR mutation, the T790M. No apparent evidence of MET amplification. She was put on docetaxel chemotherapy, minor response for seven cycles and then progression. And then she was referred to us because the story was coming out about some of these other treatments for acquired resistance and said, you know, could she be considered for, you know, maybe a third generation tyrosine kinase inhibitor for the EGFR.
And that was when you saw her?
That was the first time I saw her, yeah.
And globally, what was your impression about her? What kind of condition was she in? And what were some of the things you were thinking about?
Well, she's a very smart, very informed, very motivated individual who'd actually sought us out. And the fact that her history goes all the way back with stage 4 disease to 2009, and here we are, we're sitting when I first saw her in the middle of 2013, clearly she has a relatively indolent course of her disease. She had a little bit of discomfort in her bones, but was pretty much asymptomatic.
And what were the options you thought through with her at that point?
Well, the reason I wanted to present this case is to bring about the idea of how we understand mechanisms of acquired resistance. And so she was coming in saying, well, they've rebiopsied my cancer, you know, earlier this year, and I don't have T790M and I don't have MET amplification. So we don't know what's driving resistance to the allotinib in my case. You know, what can you do for me, doctor? And here's the way we really have to start to think about these cases, is that the cancer is adapting to its immediate environment. Now, in this case, when that woman was biopsied or rebiopsied, she had been off the allotinib for nearly 2 years. And so we can still see the EGFR mutation, but we have totally removed the environment that was selecting out a mechanism of resistance. And we know from some very elegant studies done in lots of places, very nice stuff that was done at Massachusetts General Hospital, that, you know, mechanisms of resistance wax and wane depending on the environment that they're adapting to. So T790M, which is a second mutation in the EGFR tyrosine kinase, is actually, although it turns back on signaling in the presence of allotinib, actually slightly cripples the kinase as well. So the two things alters the structural function of the kinase, and so it's a relatively indolent, relatively poor-performing resistant clone. So if you don't have the allotinib, it's not the fittest example of a clone, and it will fade away. So this lady, what I said to her is, I said, well, what you need to do is go back on the allotinib. Because she had had 2 years off any actual EGFR-directed therapy, and she had a beautiful re-response.
And I guess the question comes up, and her case is a little bit complicated, but conceptually, should she have ever gone off the erlotinib?
Well, so that is a big debate. I have gone one way and have drifted the other way in the last few years. So one is, you know, it's very satisfying to, you know, put somebody on chemotherapy, they respond, you know, you tell the cancer to look left, and then when they progress, you tell the cancer to look right, and you put them back on the tyrosine kinase inhibitor and you get a re-response. That's satisfying. No one has proven that that's better or worse than keeping the TKI going and adding in additional therapy. But I have a personal belief that at least theoretically, what you're trying to do is suppress as many growing clones of the cancer as possible. And so pretty much within the last 2 years, I have tended to add in. So if you progress on the erlotinib, I keep it going. And unless you're on a trial that mandates otherwise, when I put you on chemotherapy, I'm adding the chemo in to the erlotinib, not swapping one out for the other.
So kind of like the prostate cancer model with hormones and the HER2 model with breast cancer. And now we're seeing this with anti-angiogenics and colon cancer. What about rechallenge? What did you do with her?
So what happens is you put somebody back on, she's had 2 years off. So you can pretty much guarantee she's going to re-benefit. That's quite a long time to be off a particular selection pressure. So all of the mechanism resistance have faded away. But the levels will usually be higher than they were when she's completely TKI naive. So the honeymoon period, her PFS, that second time around is usually shorter. So she had a year the first time, and it was about 6 or 7 months before we started to see evidence of acquired resistance on that rechallenge.
She had an objective response, though?
She did. And what I did then is I re-biopsied her when she'd actually been on the erlotinib, and now she has T790M.
And what happened next?
So then I put her on a third-generation EGFR inhibitor within a clinical trial. I put her on the CO1686, and she's responded very nicely to that.
And how long has she been on that therapy?
About 4 months now.
And what has happened with her in terms of side effects? First of all, did she have any side effects with the erlotinib, and what about the CO1686?
So on the erlotinib, she had a kind of grade 1 skin rash, some grade 1 diarrhea. The 1686, along with the other third-generation inhibitors, are designed to have activity against those common activating mutations we talked about and T790M, and to have fairly significant sparing of the wild-type form of EGFR. So she had no rash, she had no diarrhea, but she did manifest what is emerging as a relatively common side effect on the 1686 in the fact that she developed some hyperglycemia. Now, she took a little while to manifest. It didn't happen in the first cycle. It started, glucose started to go up during the second cycle, but was still within the normal range. And then by the time she got to the third cycle, she was getting glucoses of, you know, 270, 280, and we put her on metformin.
Obviously, no history of a glucose intolerance previously?
No. I mean, this is a drug-induced diabetes. One of the theories is, first of all, it doesn't happen in everybody. In the study that was reported at ASCO, some grade of hyperglycemia was occurring in just over 50% of people, with grade 3 hyperglycemia occurring in about 20-odd percent of people. So it doesn't happen in everybody. And as illustrated by this lady, it doesn't happen instantaneously. What they actually think is now going on is it's not the drug itself. It's a metabolite of the drug, which may have some activity, for example, against IGF-1R, the insulin-like growth factor 1 receptor. And so if you and I were to take the same drug, maybe we would metabolize it differently. Maybe we would either make or not make this active metabolite, or maybe you would make it sooner than me or vice versa. And that, I think, is the explanation for the heterogeneity we're seeing in the side effects.
And the approach to treatment is the same as standard diabetes?
Yeah, so you'll try oral antihyperglycemics earlier. I have had some patients who've needed to go on to insulin. In people who have it bad, it can be slightly troublesome, presumably because you're actually interfering with the signaling of the IGF-1R. And so when you're trying to give exogenous insulin, some of that is also signaling through that same molecule. So in its worst case, it's actually quite troublesome to control, but in its best case, it's no harder than anyone else's diabetes.
Can you compare what is known about CO1686? There was a bunch of data that came out on all three compounds to what we know about the other two.
So there is the drug from Korea, which is billed as a third-generation EGFR inhibitor, but its response rate in T790M is really disappointingly low. It's in the sort of 20-odd percent. So that I think is falling out from the race, and it's turning very much into a two-horse race between the 1686 and then AZD 9291. They're both built on the same logic that you want to try and have relative sparing of the wild-type form, but activity at clinically achievable doses against T790M and the standard activating mutations. That margin is narrower for AZD 9291, so they are getting a little bit of skin rash. Both drugs clearly have activity. In T790M positive patients, 9291 had just over a 60% response rate. It was a high 50s% response rate with 1686. The 9291 had a T790M negative cohort, which had a sort of 22% response rate. One always wonders, almost like with this case of, you know, what truly is T790M negative? Is it some people who they have it, but you've missed it? Or is it some people who are truly driven by a different mechanism? And I think that's a kind of slightly messy territory. Hyperglycemia doesn't appear to be an issue with 9291 based on the data we've seen, although it's clearly not free from side effects. It had about a 20-odd percent grade 3 adverse event level at the 80 milligrams, which is the dose that they're taking forward. And I think there's so much excitement about these drugs, and the data is really being pumped out very quickly, and then trials are accruing so quickly that, you know, the safety data set is immature. The progression-free survival is definitely immature. Both of them have very impressive-looking PFS curves. The Clovis drug, they were claiming that, although not mature, clearly the median PFS was going to be greater than 12 months. But we still have to kind of wait and let the dust settle to see if there's a clear winner there.
Are there specific toxicities seen with the AZ compound?
Not that has been particularly presented publicly that one can sort of put your handle on. But again, I say that, you know, the data set is relatively immature. So there's some stuff that I've seen, but it's not yet in the public domain.
I know you were involved with this study, obviously. How many patients have you actually treated with the CO1686 compound?
With the 1686, 20 to 30. With the AZD9291, probably slightly less, you know, 10 to 15.
Another option that is often discussed in patients who are progressing on erlotinib or trofitinib is afatinib, cetuximab, and there was just an update published to the original series. I think you were part of that.
Yeah.
Looking at that, I always thought that was one of the more interesting studies ever presented at ASCO. Can you talk about what was seen in that and what was seen with this update, and where do you see that combination heading?
So that was recently published in Cancer Discovery with Dr. Janjigian as the first author. It's just over 100 patients. And it's the combination of afatinib at 40 milligrams and 500 milligrams per meter squared cetuximab every 2 weeks. And it had a sort of middle 30% response rate in those who were proven to be T790M and a sort of 20-odd percent response rate in those who appeared to be T790M negative. For me, it's a very interesting combination. It came from very elegant work from William Powell's lab, and essentially it shuts off all EGFR signaling. So it's almost the exact opposite of the third generation inhibitors. It's just saying, you have EGFR in any way, shape, or form. We're going to just shut it down. And not surprisingly, the side effects are pretty severe. So about 40 to 50% of people need a dose reduction, mostly because of skin toxicity, occasionally because of diarrhea. But it works. The median progression-free survival is not huge. It's something like 4.7 months. For those who have an objective response, their duration of response is about 5.7 months. And I think while that is still being considered to be explored in the Southwest Oncology Group as an alternative to actually afatinib as first-line therapy, one worries that the side effects are going to be problematic. But I think you need to remember that that combination might be there for you try your first generation slash second generation drug, maybe you're going to try your third generation, and then sure, you have chemotherapy, but you still have this relatively toxic combination, but maybe it can still give you just a few more months of control. So I don't think it's gone away. I think there have been some problems from the company point of view where you have two companies and, you know, getting them to figure out a development plan that seems equitable to them, I think has been a bit of a challenge.
So one of the themes that is going through this case is the issue of, that we referred to several times, is the issue of acquired resistance to TKIs. And you and William Powell and Lisha Sequist had this spectacular article in Nature Reviews in Clinical Oncology. And really, I'm always looking for graphics that help me explain things, and I really love the graphics in this paper, but not having the advantage of being able to show those slides. Can you just talk conceptually about what you were trying to get across in this paper?
Well, so one of the things, I mean, obviously we can talk about, you know, new drugs and how these are things, but, you know, when you're sitting in your clinic and, you know, you don't have all of these trials in your own center, one of the things we wanted to talk about is what are the things that you can do to stretch out the control in your individual patient? And so we drew some graphics of, you know, stopping the TKI and switching to chemotherapy, staying on the TKI and adding in the chemotherapy. We also talked about the idea of, you know, changing to other treatments in a clinical trial, changing to something completely different, an immune checkpoint therapy. Again, with all of these things, the worry when you go to a clinical trial that isn't focused on the EGFR, that because the trial forces you to stop usually the other TKIs, that you're sort of, you know, taking one eye off the ball. And then we talked about the emerging and still relatively controversial role of, you know, focused radiation therapy of isolated areas of progression. And so we put all of those into a graphic so that, you know, you have a menu card of things that you could try.
Let's go into your next case, the 67-year-old truck driver.
So I want to use this case to illustrate something which I've already touched on, which is the brain becoming one of the new battlegrounds that we have to address. So 67-year-old Caucasian male truck driver, never smoker. As a side note, he had a closed head injury from a motorcycle accident about 6 years before diagnosis. And he had this intermittent history of sort of tingling in his right arm, spreading up to his right neck, making him clench his teeth. And he didn't pursue any investigation of that because he was worried someone would take away his license. Eventually, he had a grand mal seizure, and the MRI of his brain was clear, and it was felt that this was primary epilepsy, secondary to his closed head injury. And he was started on levetiracetamine. That all predates his diagnosis of lung cancer, but I bring it out to just point out that his MRI of brain at that point in time, which is about 6 months prior to his diagnosis, was clear. At age 64, so this is 3 years prior to when, you know, I'm actually seeing him, he develops shortness of breath, he has atrial fibrillation, and he has a right middle lobe mass about 2.6 centimeters and a small right effusion. Staging investigations show right-sided mediastinal lymph nodes, multiple nodules in the same lobe, and pleural nodularity. So we think T3, N2, M1A. Cytology of the pleural effusion was inconclusive, so he had a CT-guided biopsy of that right middle lobe mass, which showed a TTF1-positive adenocarcinoma. EGFR mutation testing was inconclusive, but they had enough cells to perform ALK FISH analysis, which showed 94% of cells, a very high proportion, showing a split signal, i.e. he's ALK positive with an ALK rearrangement. He had been started on the community on first-line treatment with carboplatin and paclitaxel for 2 cycles. Before that result came back, his first scan showed stable disease, so they made a decision to switch him to crizotinib, which at this point in time was licensed, and he had a complete response on his first scan after about 2 or 3 months.
Before you go on, could you talk a little bit, and I know you've written about this, about the issue of ALK testing?
Well, so at the moment, there is still only one FDA-approved test, which is the Visis Breakapart FISH probe. There is no doubt that there are other methods to detect ALK positivity, but, you know, you and I cooking something up in our garage and showing it works in our own garage isn't the same way as saying that this is an FDA-approved test. I think what has really happened over the last few years is we've gone from sort of some homebrew testing done in individual centers saying, look, this looks great, to a move to actually take this to the level of rigor that you need to say, could immunohistochemistry using a specified antibody, a specific antigen retrieval mechanism, a specified staining and quantification method actually be used? And that, I think, is undoubtedly coming in the US. It's already approved, I believe, by the EMEA for immunohistochemistry for ALK testing. RT-PCR is also used by some people. There, you have to really know what the fusion partner is. So, you know, a positive is likely to be a true positive, but you could get false negatives because it's no longer just EML4 ALK, which is why we tend to say ALK rearrangements. There are other fusion partners which continue to be discovered.
If these newer techniques are used, are you expecting that more people would be classified?
Well, we published, I think, last year that when you use FISH testing, it goes on the percentage of cells in the tumor that show evidence of a rearrangement. The cut point of 15% of cells was based on a relatively small series and seemed to sit in the no man's land between sort of just the noise of the assay and clear positives. When we looked at nearly 800 cases, you could actually, not surprisingly, see a few that really came right up and towed that line. So you would get 12%, 13%, 14% positive. And you go, well, you know, if we're calling you positive and negative on the basis of one cell, you know, maybe we need to be thinking that these kind of borderline negatives do need to come in with a separate diagnostic assay. So we suggested in that paper that those are the cases that you really would want to double check by immunohistochemistry or RT-PCR.
How often does that happen?
It's about, I think off the top of my head, is about 8% of cases sort of sit in that 10 to 15% no man's land. So it's not a trivial number. But the problem is we don't know how many of them are true positive versus false positives.
Interesting. So this man goes on crizotinib. How did he do on the crizotinib in addition to the fact he had a response? What about side effects?
Tolerated very well. He had some peripheral edema, which we know is a kind of late onset side effect, seems to be related to MET inhibition. But, you know, he had the slight weird visual side effect you get. You get a kind of slowing of the off rate in your retina. So in low light conditions, you get some smearing of lights. But generally speaking, he tolerated it very well. And he had that great response that lasted for not quite a year, probably about 8 or 9 months in total.
Before we go into what happened with him, I got to just get a quick update for you. And I actually saw a paper that came out you discussed last time we talked, which is the issue of hypogonadism and crizotinib.
So it's interesting because he was actually already on testosterone replacement. So he's the one guy that we can't say with the crizotinib did anything because he was hypogonadal even before he had his lung cancer.
What was that for?
Well, you know, that happens in a certain proportion of people for endogenous reasons. We know if you take people with stage 4 lung cancer, about 30% of people will have low testosterone because of, you know, brain radiotherapy, concomitant medications, opiates can drop your testosterone, and just generally being beaten up. So the difference is, it's not that if you're on crizotinib, it's 100%, and if you're off it, it's 0%. If you're off it, it's probably about 30%, and if you're on it, it's probably about 85%.
Anything new with your research in that? And have you learned anything in terms of what happens to women?
So we have no evidence. We have looked. We haven't published it. We have no evidence of any disturbance of the gonadal axis in women. We haven't looked in a large number of people, but the ones I have, I can't find any evidence of anything going on. So it seems to be a male-specific effect. After our initial publication, which was a single center, we then repeated it in multiple centers, both nationally and internationally, and we included in an androgen deprivation questionnaire, which showed about 85% of people did have a drop in their free testosterone, and in the majority of cases, they were actually symptomatic. And in those patients who we referred to an endocrinologist, if they chose to put them on replacement therapy, there was often an improvement in those symptoms. The symptoms are very vague. I mean, they're fatigue. Yes, there can be erectile dysfunction, but there can be depression. But, you know, if you're a 80-year-old guy, it may be much less significant than if you're a 30-year-old guy. And remember, ALK-positive patients tend to be relatively young, so it's much more of an issue in that population. I'm delighted to say that Pfizer is now exploring the possibility of actually exploring this formally within one of their studies, which I think will be very interesting because it's still currently not on the FDA label. It's not even mentioned there.
And what's the actual mechanism?
Well, we don't know. We believe it's a central effect because the LH and FSH, which you would expect would go up if it was a testicular effect, actually go down. So as you may recall, your pituitary actually sits outside of your blood-brain barrier. So although crizotinib is not great at getting into the brain, it's getting into enough of the hypothalamic pituitary axis, presumably, to mess this up.
So this man has a good response. And then what was the next step?
So after about 8 or 9 months, he then develops acquired resistance. His mediastinal lymph nodes start to increase in size and are PET avid. Repeat MRI of his brain is still clear. They decide to treat the mediastinal disease because it's localized with radiotherapy. He got 30 gray in 10 fractions and remained on the crizotinib. And he did well for about another 4 months, at which point in time he was starting to get new areas popping up, new lymph nodes popping up in the infrahilar region, and an increase in size of that right middle lobe mass. And he talked about more radiotherapy, but he actually came to see us to go on a clinical trial, and we stopped the crizotinib and we put him on ceritinib, what was called LDK-378 at that point in time, at 750 milligrams. And that was in August 2013, before it was licensed. And there's good and bad news to that aspect of the story. So he responded very well to the ceritinib. It was clearly an active drug in the post-crizotinib setting, but he really found that 750 milligrams very hard to tolerate. He had very severe abdominal cramps. He had diarrhea, which would occasionally be so explosive he would have an accident, you know, on the drive to the hospital, and a lot of nausea and vomiting. And, you know, he's a tough guy, and he soldiered on for about 2 months, but then we had to reduce the dose, and we dropped him down to 600 milligrams. And he was much better tolerated. So on 600 milligrams, it was like night and day for him. His GI side effects were much more manageable. And that response, which he was having, persisted until pretty much 10 months later when, you know, I just had that kind of inkling feeling. He didn't have any symptoms, but I went, hey, you know, you never know what's going on. These drugs are supposed to penetrate into the brain, but let's just do an MRI of your brain. And every one of his brain MRIs had been clear beforehand, and now suddenly he's got innumerable. He's got the snowstorm of brain metastases. And because there were so many, he proceeded to whole brain radiotherapy. He was logged as progressing within the study, but he was actually allowed to continue on the drug. And to this day, the brain lesions are now controlled post whole brain radiotherapy. He has some side effects from that. But his systemic disease is now still very well controlled on 600 milligrams of the seretinib.
What do we know about the dose response in treating ALK rearranged disease, both with crizotinib as well as seretinib? And maybe you can talk about other agents in development.
So seretinib, the benefit was seen in almost all doses from about 450 milligrams and above. So some people have wondered whether 750 milligrams is higher than some patients need. About 60% of patients actually need a dose reduction from 750 milligrams. So it's not an easy drug to go on with at 750 milligrams. Crizotinib, it's obviously taken twice a day. I've certainly had patients down at, you know, for patients who didn't tolerate it for various reasons, down at 200 milligrams on alternate days, and they're still maintaining control of their disease. But I want to bring up here the issue that, again, you have to view the body and the brain as separate parts. You know, they're almost independent countries. And when you reduce the dose, while you may still be preserving effective levels systemically, if you're only getting a proportion into the brain, i.e. there is still a functional blood-brain barrier, you may much more dramatically drop the exposure in the brain. And my worry in this guy is that by dropping to 600 milligrams, I now essentially am under-treating his brain, and that's why he progressed there. So I think we always have to bear that in mind, that the brain is emerging as this battleground that we really have to keep an eye on, even with these second-generation drugs.
What is known about the objective response to these agents with brain mets, both crizotinib and seretinib?
So I'm glad you asked that, because we're not very good at capturing that data as to what's going on in the brain. At this year's ASCO, Dr. Kim showed really the best available data on the activity of seretinib in brain metastases, but N was 10. They had 10, but despite all of, you know, getting the drug license, hundreds of patients treated, they had 10 patients who they could identify who had untreated measurable brain metastases before going on seretinib, and four of them responded. So great. In a relatively small data set, we have a response rate of 40%, but we don't have the duration of the response. So we're getting half the picture. And, you know, I've sat down and my colleagues have all sat down with the pharmaceutical industry, and the real push is going to be to say, well, you need to capture this data. You need to capture it in enough people. You need to capture the kind of endpoints we're looking at systemically, duration of response, time to progression in the brain. And that has to come out. And it's going to be particularly important, as mentioned, when you have drugs which are less well tolerated, where you have to reduce the dose.
What about crizotinib? Have responses in the brain been observed there?
So they have been observed. Again, this is the challenge of looking at data retrospectively. Some, you know, very elegant work led as the first author by Lucio Crino, and then there is a manuscript in preparation by Dan Costa from Beth Israel, try to really pull apart what data you can capture retrospectively of crizotinib's activity in the brain. So we are seeing responses, but they are clearly at a much lower response rate than systemically, and the duration of those responses is, you know, at least half that in the body. So the impression is, in most people, it's not getting in some people it is, but even there, it's still probably under-treating.
What's your approach to the patient who presents with multiple small bilateral brain mets with ALK disease, who's asymptomatic, has not been treated? Would you consider using an ALK inhibitor before radiation therapy?
So if my choice is whole brain radiotherapy or a second generation ALK inhibitor that I think will get into the brain, I would go for the inhibitor. I think that we are seeing people who are 4, 5 and longer year survivors with stage 4 disease. And if you give someone whole brain radiotherapy, they are now living long enough to manifest some awful side effects. I have seen radiation dementia, which when I was training was this thing that was so rare you never actually saw it. And now, unfortunately, I've seen, you know, far too many cases of that. Because if you live more than about 3 or 4 years, your IQ and your memory function is going to be dropping if you have whole brain radiotherapy.
So you said you'd use a second-generation ALK inhibitor. What about a patient presenting initially up front in that situation?
Well, there are clinical trials that will allow you to put someone on a second-generation inhibitor in the TKA-naive setting.
So you wouldn't do that with crizotinib is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. So with crizotinib, I'm really worried about its activity in the brain. And so I would probably try and treat the brain. I mean, you gave me a very fixed example. If they had a smaller number of deposits, I would consider stereotactic radiosurgery and putting them on crizotinib. But because the side effects of whole brain radiotherapy are so much more significant, that might actually change my initial treatment decision.
So as long as we brought this up, obviously the same question comes up in terms of EGFR mutations. Again, patient is asymptomatic, multiple bilateral lesions. Do you start with a TKI or radiation?
Well, so I think the evidence that some EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors in some patients can have CNS activity is stronger. So the failure rate from EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors by progression in the brain is probably only about 20%, whereas it's about 50% with crizotinib. So if they had no symptoms, I would reasonably say we can start you on the tablet and keep a very close eye on you, but obviously repeating that MRI of the brain relatively soon so you could pull the trigger on radiotherapy if you had to.
Have you seen patients who you've been able to control brain mets for a prolonged period of time with EGFR mutations?
Yes.
And getting back to ALK inhibitors, what others besides ceritinib, second generation, are in development?
So alectinib is the one that we're probably going to hear most about. The phase 2 study is almost completed, which will be probably what they'll think about filing for fast track approval in. And if that works, there may even be compassionate access to alectinib relatively soon. They're adopting similar to what I described with the Tiger-1 study and the Aura-1 study. They are doing the ALEX study, A-L-E-X, which is alectinib versus crizotinib. And that's a first-line ALK TKI-naive study, again, to say, is our drug so good we can actually knock it out of the park and be, you know, the ALK inhibitor of choice.
Any other comments about this case?
I think, you know, we talked about the frequency of CNS surveillance. So what I tend to do, because the frequency of deposits in the brain is so high with ALK, I tend to look like every 6 months or so in somebody who doesn't have it. I was a bit remiss in this guy. I waited 10 months before I repeated the MRI. If somebody has known brain metastases, I'm actually looking probably as frequently as I'm looking in the rest of the body. We talked through whole brain radiotherapy versus stereotactic radiosurgery.
There was one other thing that you put in the write-up that I don't think you mentioned that I wanted to ask you about, which was this man at one point had progression in the mediastinum and you irradiated it and kept the crizotinib going.
Yeah. So we've really championed that in the last few years. So we've now got two publications on that. The first one was a combination of ALK-positive patients and EGFR mutant patients on the relevant TKI when they first developed progression. If you had non-leptomeningeal CNS progression or you had less than or equal to 4 sites of extra CNS progression, which we call oligoprogressive disease, we looked at treating those areas with radiotherapy and keeping the TKI going. And we saw 2 really interesting things came out of that. First of all, if you had just progressed in the brain, on average, it took 7 months before there was any further evidence of progression, I think consistent with the idea that that's a pharmacological failure, not a biological failure. In the body, though, you know, it was still just over 4 months, 4.1 months that we were seeing before it was progressing. So the idea that you could control these aberrant clones with focused radiotherapy, I think, is starting to come in. Our subsequent paper was a follow-up just on the ALK patient population with longer follow-up. And if you looked at those ones and we're just talking within the body now who had oligo progression, the median time to that second PFS, so we call it PFS2, was over 5 months, 5.2 months. And if you had a drug that gave you a median PFS of 5.2 months, you'd sit up and take notice. And all we're doing is creative use of radiotherapy.
So how about your other case? I love the title you put on this. Who's pan-negative are we talking about?
Well, this is, you know, if you look back at the conversations we've had over the last few years, you know, pan-negative is very much a moving situation, which I think, you know, if you were a drug company and you're trying to develop something in anything that's wild type, you know, you're going to be out of luck because that's never going to be the same population, you know, 1 year after another.
I remember there was like a really brief time where we talked about triple negative, but then all of a sudden there's a whole bunch of other new things came in.
So we did a publication, I don't know how many years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, where we were looking at pemetrexed activity, and we looked in ALK-positive, EGFR mutant, KRAS mutant, and then the control group we called triple negative. And, you know, people threw rocks at us because they said, triple negative, that's breast cancer, you can't use that term. And it didn't matter because, you know, barely a year later, we were talking about DECA negative, you know, because right, there were 10 abnormalities in the LCMC.
Right.
So I guess I just wanted to raise the example. So the case here is a 64-year-old Caucasian. He's a retired plumber, 40-pack-year smoking history, and he's still smoking. You know, you can smell it in the clinic room. He gets a painful mass in his left lateral ribs in April of this year. And imaging shows a 3-centimeter mass in his right lung base, numerous bilateral pulmonary nodules, mediastinal, supraclavicular fossa, and hilar lymphadenopathy, liver lesions, and an expansile destructive lesion in an anterior 7th left rib. So he's clearly got stage 4 disease. CT-guided biopsy of the lung shows TTF1 negative, P63 positive, poorly differentiated non-small cell carcinoma favoring squamous cancer. Brain MRI is clear. He's EGFR wild type, he's ALK and ROS1 FISH negative done in the community, and he sent to us saying, have you got anything for, you know, squamous cancer? And whilst we're figuring out what to do, he goes on first-line treatment, carboplatin, gemcitabine. They give him denosumab as well because of the bone disease. And he has a minor response, but he has lots of problems with myelosuppression. This is not good protoplasm in this guy. And we did further testing, and we now do a next-generation sequencing panel. We do FISH analysis for ALK, ROS1, MET, and RET. And this guy had a RET rearrangement. And he's also PD-L1 positive because we test that within a clinical trial. And I wanted to bring it up because sometimes when we find these new abnormalities, so, you know, one of the groups, Bob Doble at our institution, together with Dana-Farber, described NTRK rearrangements in lung cancer a year or so back. You know, when you find these things, your data set of positives is very small. You know, it might be a few less than 10 or less than 20 patients. And sure, we can say, well, what do those 20 patients have in common? You know, were they adeno, were they squamous, were they smokers, were they never smokers? And the danger is that on the basis of a tiny data set, we fossilize that into prejudice and we say, well, you know, none of the RET abnormalities occurred in people who had, you know, anything other than adenocarcinoma. Therefore, we should only test adenocarcinoma. And if we do that, we will never have the true discovery. So you have to have a very high index of suspicion that what you're seeing is the people who are most likely to have that abnormality. But I mean, I have a philosophy which is, if there's enough tissue and the patient's insurance will cover it, unless there is a 0% chance of an abnormality, I will still try and find it in you.
So that means you test for EGFR and ALK in smokers with squamous cell?
I do. I have a long-running and enjoyable discussion with Corey Langer about this. So I asked Corey, and in fact, you may remember, I think I did it in one of your sessions. So I asked Corey, I said, do you test for ROS1 rearrangement? He goes, absolutely. And I go, what's the frequency of that? About 2%. And you go, do you test for EGFR mutations in squamous cancer? He goes, no, never. And you go, what's the frequency of EGFR mutations? It's about 2%. So you got to, I mean, you can do what you like as long as you're logically consistent.
I'm actually interviewing Corey in a couple of days. I'm going to bring this back up to him. Anyhow, what happened with this man?
Well, so he's about to start on a RET inhibitor next week. So as I said, the problem with the RET inhibitors is they're all repurposed drugs. So people have used sunitinib, people have used cabozantinib. We have a clinical trial with ponatinib. You know, these are drugs which all happen to hit RET but are really licensed for treating something else. So they bring with them some baggage in terms of, you know, what you might call unnecessary side effects. But he's fit enough and we'll put him on and hopefully he'll respond.
Have you seen people respond objectively in this situation?
I have. So certainly I've had a number of patients who've been treated off-label with cabozantinib who have a RET rearrangement, and they will have a good response. They do have problems with mucositis, as that's one of the side effects of that drug, and sometimes you have to reduce the dose. But, you know, it is a driver abnormality.
What drug is he going to receive?
He's going to receive ponatinib.
Ponatinib. You know, I've been hearing about that in lung cancer, and it's fascinating. It's hard to compute. I mean, I just keep thinking of CML, but what do we know about ponatinib?
So it's clearly a, you know, a BCR-ABL inhibitor, which is what it got its license for, and with, you know, remarkable activity in some of the resistance mutations you get in CML. But, you know, none of these kinase inhibitors are clean. It also has clear activity against RET, and it has activity against some of the FGFRs. So we're exploring it in the clinical trial, both for RET rearrangements, and we're looking at FGFR1 activation in a very different way. So FGFR1 amplification had been explored in some studies, which with relatively disappointing response rates in squamous cancer, with patients proven to have an FGFR amplification, maybe sort of 8 to 10% response rate. What we think is going on is that FGFR may be driving some cancers, but through increased expression, even in the absence of increased copy number. So we actually have an assay which is looking at mRNA levels that we do an in situ assay for.
So final question. At ASCO, you presented some data on crizotinib in c-MET amplified disease. What did you see there and where do you see it heading?
So it's a wonderful story. So crizotinib, you know, when I first encountered it in 2006, was billed as a MET inhibitor. And that story never went away. It just got overshadowed by, you know, the train of activity in ALK and then ROS1. But those fires kept burning, and we presented for the first time data on the MET amplified lung cancer. Now, MET is a much more complex biomarker. So it's not just is it there or isn't. You can actually assess it in a number of different ways. You can assess MET by immunohistochemistry. What we were looking at here was the copy number. So although copy number may not be a great biomarker for FGFR1 activation in MET, it is. But you also have to remember you can quantify that in a number of different ways. You can look at the mean copy number of MET per cell. You can look at the mean copy number of the centromere that it sits on, which is centromere in chromosome 7 per cell, and then divide one by the other and get the ratio. So that's the MET amplification ratio. And each of those is a continuous variable, and you have to decide where to put the cut point. We decided to go in, so it's a FISH assay. We decided that amplification, so ratio of the gene to the centromere, was going to reflect the true biology that this was being selected for by the cancer more than just the copy number. And then we put it into different groups. So ratios of amplification of 1.8 to 2.2, 2.2 to 5, and then greater than 5. And there's a clear difference. The numbers are still small. There was like 6 patients in the intermediate and high group and only 2 patients in the low group. Nobody in the low group responded. We had a 17% response rate in the intermediate group. We had a 67% response rate in the high amplified group. These are people with a MET to SEP7 ratio of greater than 5. And the responses are just unbelievable. They last for years. I mean, the median duration of response is something like 72 weeks. And the other really important thing is this isn't your Asian adenocarcinoma never smoker. These are people, something like 13 out of the, you know, 15 or 16 patients in it all had some kind of smoking history, often a heavy smoking history. So, you know, there's hope for everybody, even for the heavy smokers.